We are on the threshold of oneness. We have seen how when we withdraw our concentration of consciousness that is normally fixed on our body, mind and life, and turn it inwards, we come to the status of ourself. Persisting there, we perceive and realize the identity of this self deep within us with an immutable reality, what the Upanishads call the Brahman, at the back of all. And if we persist still further, through this immutability, through this immobile reality, we pass into an impersonality from the bounds of our personality. We enter the domain of the transcendent reality. It is possible that on the way, if our path is not too narrow, we have the experience of the cosmic consciousness, consciousness of the universe around us. We also realize the Lord of the universe, the Divine is the Lord of the universe. But these are all experiences on the path, circumstances that one passes through, but the goal is always transcendence in impersonality, in silence. This is the goal of the traditional path of knowledge. But that is not all. Sri Aurobindo points out that having reached the status of transcendence, it is possible to turn back and through the cosmic consciousness realize also the one reality in its multitudinous aspect. Not only realize the Brahman in his immobile status, but also in his variegated mobility of status and movement. The seeker of the integral knowledge pursues this path. He realizes the Satchidananda, the reality of existence, consciousness and bliss in its unity on every level, but unity coterminous with the diversification of that unity into multiplicity. At every stage, he realizes this existence as one and many, this consciousness force as originally one, but throwing itself out multiple, one delight streaming into varied currents of joy, pleasure and delight. It is when he holds to this conception of Satchidananda on every plane that he doesn't lose his grip over the manifestation. Sri Aurobindo describes how the seeker of the integral path of knowledge, realizes in his own being on the seven planes of creation which are reproduced in himself, this truth of Satchidananda. He first realizes that there is a sheer existence, an absolute which is not touched by anything that goes out or comes back. It is always there. Whatever else may be or may not be there, there is this existence, one soul. On every plane, there is this reality at the back. On its own plane of existence, the highest, the seeker who has the realization also views the spread out of this existence, the spread out of this unity into a multiple unity. This multiple unity is not arrived by totaling up all that you see into one total. The reality is everywhere. Wherever you see, it is the same reality. That is why it is called one. Essentially, the one existence is everywhere. Similarly, the consciousness and the force of that consciousness, though essentially one, they are thrown about, self-diversified, in a million energies, in a million thought forces, but all deriving from the one original chit. So too, the one delight, the ocean of bliss that is one, underneath all creation, it throws out so many jets, so many waves of its currents, which we call, according to our capacity of receiving or not being able to receive in ourselves, as joy, pleasure, pain. When, with our limited capacity, we are unable to hold the charge of the delight of existence that throws itself on us, we call it pain. When, by discipline, we are able to enlarge our consciousness, the base of our consciousness, and can receive, can embrace the wave of delight that comes us fully, upon us fully, there is no more pain. Thus, the first step to eliminate pain and suffering is to enlarge ourselves, to break out of the walls of our division which are erected by our ego. After the delight, there is the truth mind, the truth principle, which is always in possession of the one truth, but directing so many flames from the one fire of truth, each on its carrier, but always in the background of that unity. Then there is the mind. The mind gradation of Satchidananda, where all is one consciousness at the mental level. This is parceled out apparently in a million minds, but in spite of the figure, it is the one mind. So too, the life force, which is fragmented into so many forms, each of which insists on being separate from the other, and there is the universal matter, out of which all forms are shaped, and when they are broken, all forms go back. Universal matter. These are the seven gradations of Satchidananda, which the seeker of the integral knowledge has to realize. He not only realizes, in his experience, in his consciousness, but he has to build up a vision in which he sees every movement of life, every form of life, every experience of life in terms of this unity of Satchidananda. There is also another aspect. There are what are called the upper and the lower hemispheres of existence. The upper belt, that of Satchidananda proper, the Satchidananda is unveiled, is revealed to experience. But in the lower hemisphere, he is veiled, he is clouded. What we call the organization of mind is really a projection of the consciousness aspect of Satchidananda. But the consciousness aspect is held back, is veiled by the fragmented formation of mentality. Similarly, the life force, the life world is a projection again of the force of consciousness above, the tapas, which because of fragmentation and division confesses to a certain importance, disintegration, and does not manifest the omnipotence of the original consciousness force. So also, matter is the sensible mold of the spirit. As Sri Aurobindo describes it, it is the robe of the spirit. If the spirit is concealed, that is because there is the veil and the cloud of ignorance. As the yoga of knowledge proceeds, one begins to link the upper and the lower hemisphere, realize the higher truth as expressed, however, in a deformed manner in the lower terms. But even the best of us, as long as we stand on the summits of the mind, work under a certain handicap, and we never have the full figure of the higher Satchidananda being reflected below. It is only when we open our consciousness to the intermediate link of the supramental consciousness, the supermind or the truth mind, that the bridge begins to be healed. The reality, higher reality in its integralness, begins to communicate itself to the lower intelligence through the truth mind. The Veda describes how when man rises to the level of this brilliantly lit mind, the luminous mind of the sun, seven rivers flow down. They are the rivers of inspiration, illumination, intuition, and of many other kinds, which reveal the character to the practitioner of yoga. It is only when this downpour from the supramental consciousness is affected that the gulf between the lower and the higher hemispheres begins to get healed, and we have a truly one perspective, one unbroken gradation from the depths of insentient matter to the heights of the supernal existence, consciousness, bliss. This then is the process of the integral yoga of knowledge, not the traditional yoga of knowledge, mind you. In its process, in its working, you would see that the goals of all the traditional three paths of knowledge, of works, of love, they are fulfilled. For the yoga of knowledge aims at knowing the truth of existence. What after all is true? What is the true nature of my own existence? The integral yoga of knowledge first gives you this realization that I am not different. I am not other than he who is the Satchidananda. This is declared in the famous formula, he am I, so aham. When this realization is obtained, there is a unique oneness between myself and between he who pervades and transcends all creation. As a consequence, one also sees him not only in unity with myself, but in unity with all around me. I realize my oneness not only with the Satchidananda Purusha, but in the cosmic Purusha as well. My union with him is fulfilled in my union with him in other form. I realize the Lord of existence, the Lord of the universe, whose will pervades and controls all the movements. And once having perceived that will of the Master, Master of my existence and Master of the million existences around, my will tunes itself to that will. I cease to work for my salvation. I cease to work for the salvation of others as well. But I cease to fulfill, I work to fulfill that Master will, of which I begin to see my own will is a tiny projection. This is the grand aim of the yoga of work. And third, having realized the reality as the Supreme Person above and behind the universe, as the Lord of the universe within the cosmos, I also perceive him in his aspect of delight, of bliss, which expresses itself in the universe as the fount of love. After all, love is an expression taken by bliss. Bliss wants to enjoy itself. It posits itself in one form, takes another form, bridges, and this interchange, this swallowing up of one bliss by another bliss, one form of bliss by another form, is love. Diffusion, union. This realization of the love aspect and the bliss aspect of Satchidananda is the third grand aim of the yoga of devotion. These three aims are successively fulfilled by the practice, successful practice of the yoga of integral knowledge. To one who has arrived at this crown of achievement, there are no human problems. As the Upanishad says, how shall he grieve? What problem shall he have who sees everywhere oneness? Problem arises when there is a second. Fear arises when there is another. When you see all as one, there is no room for any problem. This is the theme of oneness. Before we start yoga, we must have a mental appreciation of this truth of oneness. As we proceed, we must always remember this oneness. Recall it to our mind whenever we are threatened with division in our own consciousness, division with others, when we feel left out. We have to evoke this truth of oneness. And the traditional means to practice, to make real to ourselves this sense and truth of oneness, is in the celebrated mantra that is known as Om. It was only last week that I was given the text of a letter written by a devotee to Mother some years ago. He had written, "It often occurs to me to beg thee for a key word for japa." The mother gave Om, and that was no surprise, for the mother has always attached a special importance to this word of words, and there was a time when she was daily repeating it audibly in her chamber. I remember this particularly because she had explained at that time how the word is to be pronounced. Most people accent the first syllable and the last petals off. The mother pointed out that all the syllables should be clearly and fully articulated, and especially the last must be rounded up with amplitude and clarity. I tried it and found a difference in the vibrations set up when the M is left half enunciated or swallowed up and when it is pronounced clearly. Most people, in their hurry to repeat the mantra 100 times, 200 times or whatever it is, they go on saying Om, Om, Om. Mother said that the last syllable we just swallow. She said you have to clearly pronounce it, Om. Any questions?
Last time you talked about widening of consciousness, this time you mentioned the end. I'd like to know more idea what you mean by it. I know I have my mind that you said about broadening ever on this knowledge.
At the level where one is aware, my emotions, my feelings, I begin by extending to embrace not merely my own interests, but the interests of those around me. After some time, though the interests of those who are not connected with me, but still are there, they are also manifestations of God. Similarly, my mental thoughts, thinking, the area in which they move has to be gradually and willfully extended to cover broader and broader areas, so that there is a continuous, ceaseless effort on the conscious levels of my being to leave my ego-centered self and expand myself, to identify myself with larger and larger circles of humanity. Side by side, I recognize that beyond what is perceptible, beyond what is sensible to me, there are realms of consciousness and being. And I consciously strive to open out into those broader and larger regions of consciousness. This effort starts mentally, gradually creates certain grooves in nature by which all movements tend to flow into broader currents. The idea is to broaden my ego more and more till the island ego joins its continent.
It will also become sensitive to what is around it,
yes,
by that process.
Definitely. Sri Aurobindo describes in his chapter on the cosmic consciousness that the heart beats in unison with the heartbeats of all. The vibrations of joy and suffering, they fall on you. But that is only the first step. To suffer the sufferings of others is only the first step. As one rises above, one can understand, take note of the sufferings of others without suffering oneself, but give a healing touch. From his higher position, he can direct waves of understanding, waves of sympathy that will help the suffering brethren. The identification is complete. At times very inconvenient also, because even the thoughts of others echo in the corridors of my mind. But they are all stages, and if one persists, the path forms itself.
Then as one gradually becomes aware, periphery becomes less behind, the ego separation. Would you say
the ego is dissolved at a certain stage in this consciousness growth, in this expansion of consciousness? The ego is certainly dissolved, but the psychic center remains. It becomes strong, becomes active as a point for the radiation of the infinity, for the functioning from a particular point of the light. The center continues in the oceanic being of the cosmic person. The center continues, but it is an individuality without wall. It is, so to say, a focusing point for a particular stress of consciousness and expression.
I was trying to separate that egoic wideness from the sense of the infinite wideness that comes when you experience the
Ego thins off. after a certain stage, the ego thins off. Unless one pervertly stays at the vital level and, like Hitler, like Stalin, you know, becomes a center of the vital ego of domination, that is a deformation. The seeker knows, and the shadows of the vital he always keeps out. Of course, there can also be a mental ego, a colossal mental ego, who feels that his philosophy is the only salvation, and he insists on imposing it on every mind. So the ego has many personalities. It is only if the psychic is awakened that the ego does not get the scope to posture, to pose as the true divine.
In an actual work like the building of the Mathurandir, which demands of all those engaged in it the manifesting of perfection in his work, how can a harmony be achieved, a oneness, when there are varying levels of consciousness at work on it, particularly at the core of it, designing and structuring? How can that harmony be achieved when there are these various levels and the work has its own momentum?
In such a dynamic situation, there can never be a total and a final harmony at any stage, because so many elements are involved, each with its own level of consciousness. Mother says that if each one, at any rate, those who are awakened, take care to function at the highest level of the consciousness they have attained each, there is generated a certain force of goodwill which breaks down the elements of friction. Each one functions at his best and highest, but even though he knows that what he has is the right solution, he will not impose it on others who are unwilling to accept it. He will have an understanding of the inability of others to fall in. So he accepts for the time being the consensus, the largest consensus that is arrived at or that is possible at the moment, but goes on exerting a silent pressure in all humility from within on the situation. You exert from your level, I exert from my level. But ultimately, if our exertion of our willpower is free from ego, from wanting to prove myself right and others wrong, it does create a movement in a subtle way in the right direction. And something happens to convince the other that it is not the right thing. Or those obstructing elements are removed from the scene. But in no case should work be hampered. One can always try, with the means at one's disposal, to convert others to one's own point of view. But should he fail, he shall not sulk. He shall not deny his cooperation. In a collective effort, one has to carry as many people as possible. That is why success in a collective effort is always more difficult. The general level of life in a collective effort is lower than individually. If work suffers or is allowed to suffer as a result of such a situation, we have to take it as the working, as the way of the working of the higher will. There is a meaning. Work is not an end in itself. Work is a field of the, for the growth of consciousness. You grow by doing the work well. Another person grows by committing faults. The way of growth of each is not the same. Mother said, I remember, be at the height of your consciousness. Find out the area of agreement with others. Station yourself there and try to extend that area. Quoting verbatim, but this is the, I think something like that she said, but the sense is right. Be at the height of your consciousness. Find areas of agreement. Station yourself there and extend that area. In the large scheme of things, if you look back, in the long range view, it is not only the right doings that contribute, even certain wrong doings go to contribute towards the eventual success. They open certain hidden corners, expose some other areas, hidden areas. Contributing to the general perfection at the end. It is not deformation, it is a kind of arrestation of bliss, because you are not in a position to sustain it, it is suppressed. And you feel, still the character of it you feel as certain quiet joy, but it looks like exploding. It looks as if you will explode with that. That shows that the system is not ready to support a larger dose of bliss. Pleasure, pain, indifference, dullness, they are all gradations in the manifestation of bliss.